I want to notice several verses of Scripture this morning in the beginning. And the first one is in the 23rd chapter of Acts, the first verse. And Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." Then in 1 Timothy, the 3rd chapter and the 9th verse, says, "Holding the mystery of the faith in a pure conscience." In Titus, the 1st chapter and the 15th verse, it says, "Unto the pure all things are pure, but unto them that are defiled and unbelieving is nothing pure, but even their mind and conscience is defiled." Hebrews 9:14 says, "How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" Hebrews 10:22 says, "Let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water." 1 Timothy, the 4th chapter and the 2nd verse, says, "Speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron." In the 8th chapter of 1 Corinthians, we will read verses 7 to 11. "Howbeit there is not in every man that knowledge. For some with conscience of the idol unto this hour eat it as a thing offered unto an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. But meat commendeth us not to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, neither if we eat not are we the worse. But take heed lest by any means this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to them that are weak. For if any man see thee which hast knowledge sit at meat in the idol's temple, shall not the conscience of him which is weak be emboldened to eat those things which are offered to idols? And through thy knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died." That's 1 Corinthians 8, verses 7 through 11. And in 1 John, the 3rd chapter and verse 20, "If our heart condemn us, God is greater than our heart and knoweth all things." Well, that's kind of a conglomerate, isn't it? Maybe you wonder why I read so many different texts that are on so many different lines of thought. But in all these texts, there's a common denominator, and that's the conscience. Every one of them referred to the conscience. And that's what I want to speak to you about a little bit now, is your conscience. Now, I believe that we can readily see from all these different scriptures that I read, and all the different kinds of conscience that it mentioned in these scriptures, I believe we can see that people's conscience can get in almost any kind of a shape. And therefore, the old saying that exists among us, let your conscience be your guide, isn't always a good rule to go by. Now, we read about a good conscience, a pure conscience, a defiled conscience, a purged conscience, an evil conscience, a seared conscience, a weak conscience, an emboldened conscience, and a wounded conscience, and a condemned conscience. And there's another one that I didn't read in the 9th chapter of Hebrews in verse 9. It said, which was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices, which could never make him who did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience. Now we have an imperfect conscience. Therefore, we should be able to conclude at the very outset that conscience is no standard for the church. If we have a dozen different people, their consciences might be in a dozen different states and conditions. Therefore, that cannot set the standard for the church. The standard for the church is God's Word.
Amen.
We must go by that.
Regardless
of what I think about this or what you think about that, God's Word is a settlement for everything pertaining to our Christian life. Now, if a person has a good conscience, his conscience will smite him for anything that isn't good. If his conscience is pure, it's going to hold him to a pure standard of life. Anything impure, words, thoughts, deeds, actions, anything impure, will smite his conscience if his conscience is pure. But now you take a person with a defiled conscience, and that kind of conscience will allow defiling things in his life and never smite him. His conscience is affected that way. A person with an evil conscience can do evil things and not feel bad about it. That's the way their conscience is. You take a person with a seared conscience and he can do just about anything he wants to do, and that's all right. Everything goes with a person like that. If his conscience is seared. I talked to a man once about his need of God and seeking salvation. He was a man who drank heavily. And he squandered his money. Didn't have money to pay the bills. And to take care of the needs of the home and to supply the groceries and the clothes and the things that were needed. Well, maybe he kind of mistreated his wife otherwise, besides that kind of neglect. He kind of mistreated her otherwise. But when I talked to him about salvation, about his need of the Lord in his life, you know what that fellow told me? He says, "I don't do anything I'm ashamed of." What kind of a conscience did that man have? Well, it seemed to be pretty dead, whatever it was. Now, an imperfect conscience will allow you to do things that are not right and your life be imperfect, but it won't smudge in unless it gets into things pretty rank, see? Then that conscience might smudge you, but it won't demand a perfect life out of you. Now, our conscience can be conditioned. And our conscience can be educated. It is a creature of education and is subject to the influences around it. Now, I have read where that in some heathen lands, it is thought to be required that they throw their first child in the river to the crocodiles to appease the wrath of their God. Now that's the way they worship, that's what they believe, and whenever their first child comes along, it goes in the river to feed the crocodiles. Now them folks believe that, and their conscience would smite them almost to death if they would withhold their child from sacrifice and appeasing the wrath of their God. Now in our country, where there is enlightenment and we know better than that, our conscience would smite us almost to death if we did throw one of our children in the river to the crocodiles. We see then that one person's conscience may condemn him and smite him for doing something that another person's conscience will condemn and smite them for not doing. It's the way the conscience is educated. It is controlled and directed by what we believe. Yet at the same time, the conscience is an important part of us. And I would urge anyone to keep your conscience clear. Don't violate your conscience, whatever condition your conscience may be in. If we keep a tender conscience, then God can lead us on out of any error we're in our conscience, and perfect us in the course of time. Now, when God created man, he created him in his own image after his own likeness. Now, God is a moral being and man is a moral being. In the image of God, after his likeness, possessing his nature, and in his very nature are certain clearly defined moral discrimination. Discriminating between right and wrong, good and evil. Man's actions are not determined by mere instinct, expediency, or self-interest, but they are regarded as possessing in themselves a certain clearly defined rightness and wrongness. This is a God-given something. Certain things do not become wrong just because certain people do them. For instance, robbing banks didn't become wrong just because John Dillinger and Henry Starr and Jesse James and the Younger Brothers, fellows like that, robbed banks. That didn't make it wrong. You see, it's just the other way around. Doing wrong things make people wrong. Those men were wrong because they did wrong things, but the things that they did didn't make the things themselves wrong. They were already wrong. And them doing those things that were wrong made them wrong. It's the same way with righteousness. It is the definite, clearly defined reaction of moral principles of right and wrong on the moral nature of the individual involved. Now, in Genesis, the first chapter, and verse 27, God said, "Let us make man in our own image." Now this image, the fourth chapter of Ephesians, verse 24, says, in salvation, describing salvation and what we receive in salvation, it says, "We have put on the new man, which after God is created in righteousness and true holiness." Now that's the image of God. That's the likeness of his nature. That's what man had in the beginning. When he came fresh from the hand of God, he had righteousness and true holiness written in his very nature. In Ecclesiastes, the 7th chapter and verse 29, Solomon said, "This one thing have I found. God made man upright, but he has sought out many inventions." Now when God made him, he was upright, and he was righteous, and he possessed true holiness. Now Solomon says that he has sought out many inventions, and just the way this text reads, he made man upright, but he has sought out many inventions, would certainly indicate to us that his inventions that he had sought out and his discoveries that he had made had not helped his uprightness any. Had not blessed him in his moral nature. In fact, it has had just the opposite effect. Everything that man invents and every discovery he makes tends in that direction to make him feel more self-sufficient, more independent, less need of God, and so on. Now, in Genesis, the first chapter and verse 31, after God had created all things and his work was finished, and man was on the earth, God had made him and had made him an helpmeet, made a woman to be with him, and he looked over all the work of his hands, the creation that he had made, including the man and the woman. And he said it was all good and very good. There was not a thing wrong with it. When it come fresh from the hand of God. It was in the image of God. And righteousness and true holiness was written right in his very conscience. And he possessed the attributes of God within his very innermost being. Man at creation had the perfect and complete law of righteousness and true holiness written in his conscience, and that was all he had. That is the only law he had. That was all he needed. Now God gave one commandment, but the commandment was just a reminder of the law of right and holiness in his conscience, and to give workability to it. Now, man violated that commandment. And as a result, there was a change in his moral nature took place. We have a text now in the 5th chapter of Romans, in verse 14, it said, "Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression." Now, death reigned from Adam to Moses. As a result of Adam's sin, death came, and separation from God. God drove out the man. He didn't commune with him and walk and talk with him as he had prior to this time. He was separated from God, and that constituted death. When the soul was separated from God, its maker and creator and source of life, that soul was dead. Adam went right on and lived for I don't know how long after that time. The Bible tells what he did and the sons and daughters that he begat after that time. But his soul was dead, and that condition reigned from Adam to Moses, even over them that had not sinned after the similitude of Adam's transgression. Now, I stumbled at this for a while, and I wondered how this could be. The time came one time when I needed this text, and I was praying and seeking God to give me an understanding of this text. It fit right in with some other things, and I needed it. And so after I had been out praying for quite a little while and seeking the Lord about this text, I went in the house, and I said to Opal, I said, "There's a text in the Bible that I need to know what it means." Now, there are several texts in there that I don't know what they mean, but I don't bother about them. I just let them alone unless something comes up that I actually need to understand that. Then I begin to seek into it. That's what happened here. I've just been going on leaving this text alone. I didn't understand just how it was, but I needed it now. So I said to her, "There's a text in the Bible that I'd like to know what it means. I need that text now for some things that I was involved in." She said, "Well, what is it?" I quoted this to her, and she had the answer right quick. She says, "What kind of a sin did Adam commit?" I said he crossed over the commandment of God. Well, she said, God drove him out from the garden, and that commandment didn't exist anymore. And from the time of that experience there until the giving of the law of Moses, there was no commandment. Well, I could see it easy then. And it so ran through it. People were sinning, but they did not have a direct commandment that they were conflicting with. Well, then the question would arise, how were they sinning? If there were no commandment, how were they sinning? They were sinning against their conscience. That's the only law they had, was the law of their conscience. And they were violating that, and Adam's sin had produced a fall from righteousness and brought about a change in his moral nature and placed him and all his posterity under the dominion of sin until they were not able to live up to their own conscience. Now that's the only kind of sin that could be committed from Adam to Moses, was a sin against the conscience. They had no other law. They had no commandment during that entire period, and that was for more than 2,000 years. Now, in the third chapter of Galatians, in verse 19, he said the law was added because of transgression until the seed should come. Transgression of what? There was no commandment in existence. What was the transgression? It was just a transgression of their conscience. The law of God, the law of right and wrong, moral discrimination, was written right in their very conscience, but as they continued to sin against their conscience, they were under the dominion of sin till they could not live up to the law of their conscience. And as they continued to sin against their conscience and drift farther and farther away from the law of God and right, it became more and more dim in their conscience. They lost the vision. They lost their power of moral discrimination between right and wrong, good and evil. We have a text in Isaiah, I don't remember where it is right now, but it speaks of those who put light for darkness and darkness for light, good for evil and evil for good, got everything all mixed up in their moral perception and in their understanding, and have lost their power and ability to discriminate between right and wrong, good and evil, truth and error, light and darkness. And these things become more and more dim as we continue to violate our conscience. Now, my advice to you is to never cross over your conscience. Now, your conscience may be weak. Your conscience may be imperfect. Your conscience may need some education, but don't ever violate your conscience. Don't ever cross over that, because to do so is to just limit more and more your power of moral discrimination and the distinction between truth and error and light and darkness and good and evil and right and wrong in your understanding. As people dabble with their conscience, it becomes easy for them to dabble more with their conscience. One step leads to another, and to do one thing a little bit wrong will soon result in doing something else that's more wrong, And the trend is always downward, and the drift is always away from God and right. So just don't dabble with your conscience. Keep your conscience clear and keep your conscience as tender as you can. Don't allow your conscience to get hardened by just riding over your conscience, callousing it. The Bible speaks of it as being seared with a hot iron. Now, these people came into a state and condition where in the 6th chapter of Genesis, in verse 5, is that God saw that the imaginations and thoughts of men's hearts were only evil continually. They were just going after evil. They were thinking evil. Their imaginations were evil. Their hearts were filled up with evil. And all that they'd been doing all the way along was just violating their conscience, riding over it, and dabbling with it. Listen, God gave you and me the law of God written in our conscience. And if we never did dabble with it at all, if we were always true to our own conscience, we would have a clearly defined moral discrimination. And everything that was wrong, maybe we couldn't define the wrong in it, but it would just be repulsive to us. We just shove it away. I might not know what's the matter with it, but it just don't register in my conscience. Take care of your conscience. And let God lead you out of any error you might be in, a wrong understanding in your conscience. But don't ever give it up till you've got good grounds to give it up. If your conscience binds things on you more than what is actually substantiated in the Holy Scriptures, don't give it up till you've got good grounds to give it up. Just stand true to your own conscience. If God enlightens you, if He blesses you with a broader understanding, if He reveals light and truth to you, that helps you to see that you've been holding on to something that isn't required of God, then you can give it up. But not until then, or it'll do you damage. In Romans, the 1st chapter, in verse 19, He says, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. Now, He's talking about Gentile people here. He's talking about people that did not know the true God. But He says, that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. Now, I believe that every child that's born into this world comes here, and as he has a law right in him, and as he develops in his moral perception and in his understanding, that law becomes distinct to him. God has put in every individual sufficient light, knowledge, and understanding to enable every individual to live his life as he should if he just never tamper with it, see. Never dabble with his conscience. Now, He said God has showed it unto them, those Gentiles, those pagans out there. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Every individual stands responsible before God. Certainly every one of us do. But people out there that don't know God at all, they're responsible creatures too. There is sufficient evidence. God has given sufficient witness of himself till he said even the heathen is without excuse. The Gentiles, anybody that hadn't dabbled with their conscience, they have some understanding of God and God's will. But he says here concerning these folks, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Now they knew God. They had the law of God written in their conscience. They had a power of moral discrimination to draw the line between right and wrong, and good and evil, but they didn't glorify God, and they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. So he said that God gave them, they became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Now in the 28th verse of this first chapter of Romans, he said, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. Now there's just something about human nature, about people, that anything that kind of crosses over what they want to do, they just don't like to hear that, and they don't like to believe that, and they're reluctant to receive that. And these people, they had the knowledge of God. He was revealed to them, but they didn't like to retain God in their knowledge. And God gave them over to reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whispers, backbiters, and a whole lot of other evil things that it mentions here. It's dreadful to think of the condition that people can get into when they dabble with their conscience till they lose their perceptiveness of moral discrimination and the power and ability to draw the line between right and wrong and truth and error and good and evil and light and darkness. Then they can get in desperate states and conditions. And the world is getting more and more in a desperate state and condition in their moral standards and in their perceptiveness of right and wrong. We're living in an age today where there's not much moral discrimination. Everything, anything goes. If you feel all right about it, well, that's all right. We don't bother you, and you don't bother us. That's just the way the world's living today. And that's, they're just being filled up with all this kind of wickedness. I read a little piece just yesterday by Paul Harvey. Maybe some of you listened to his news comments on the radio, but he was discussing in this little piece how that they had told us so and so things would be better if we'd do this and we'd do that and so on. Well, he said we did that, and said they told us if we would lay down our, I don't know now just what he said, ideas about sex and just throw things wide open that there wouldn't be so many sex crimes, says, well, we did that, and says sex crimes have increased 10% this year over what they were, and said they told us, he went on down the line, different things, and how we did that. We listened to them, and the evil had increased by abundance, large percentages on every department, every phase and area you could mention. Evil had just increased and abounded because we did what they said. They told us that this would help this situation and that would help that situation, and if we just compromise here, why, this would be better. And how that those things had just skyrocketed in their percentage of increase of violations along those lines. Well, that's the way the world's going. And this describes what they're all being filled up with because they didn't like to retain God in their knowledge. Man don't like to look at himself, does he? We had in our Sunday school lesson this morning that as in water, face answers to face, so the heart of man to man. Well, now, that's true. We discussed that some, but I was thinking just how much more than the heart of man to God. How things reflect there. How they look there when we look at the nature of God. And when we compare things as they are with us, with the nature of righteousness and true holiness in His perfection as it exists in God, how does it reflect? What do we see there? Well, time's run out on me. It catches me quite often. But I'm going to have to break at this point. And I trust that the comments have been a blessing and will be profitable to all of us this morning.